thought it was a Russian satellite at first.
Then we had other radio stations and TV stations and so forth calling about this thing that had landed in Kecksburg.
But at 19 years old, I was still curious. Actually, I went back in there, was out of curiosity to see if there was something that did land there. It looked like it plowed into the ground somewhat. Radiating off, I don't know if it was the front or the back or side, was a blue light, much like a welder's light. It gets real bright and then it gets dull.
I never seen so many people, and the Army was there. I couldn't figure out how the Army got there so quick.
Along the road were state police, and there were some military people there. And I believe they were Army people, and they had guns. They were keeping people from going back into this field.
Welcome back, folks, to your favorite podcast, That Would Be Rad, the podcast that majors in 80s and 90s nostalgia, comic culture, all things paranormal, and minors in retro video games, tabletop RPGs, pre-internet mysteries, Pokemon trading cards, and raising our kids to be half as cool as we were back in the 80s. I'm your host, Tyler Bentz, and this is your other host,
Woody Brown.
Hey, pal.
Hey, man.
Man, we've really, really went off the deep end on this Pokemon card collection.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, big time. My daughter Amelia and I are, kind of obsessed a little bit.
Well, she's one of us, man.
Yeah, you know? She is.
I think our kids are following those footsteps pretty.
Quickly. Yeah. Amelia really is kind of like a mini me version, of me, as they say.
Yeah.
But it all kind of started, I guess, with. I don't know if I'd said that. I think I did mention this on an episode, but it kind of started where there was like national like Pokemon Day or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they had at the local GameStop, they had like a trade and play event. And mm-hmm. It's really cool because like there are some like adults there with like their binders and cards and stuff. But like for the most part, it's like all like pretty young kids and they show up with their binders and like it's just the most amazing thing to see. I don't know, to like see them sort of like wheeling and dealing and mm-hmm. and like being like, oh, well, I don't want to let go of that one, but I am willing to trade this. And would you do it with this? And like, I don't know. It's cool because I think in this age where kids are just glued to their tablets mm-hmm. and just staring down, like it's cool to see like, you know, a little mini microcosm of like industry happening and your kid like interacting in that sort of capacity. It's really cool.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a taste of our own childhood, you know, like with baseball cards.
Oh, right, yeah.
And all comics. That stuff. And yeah, dude, it's cool. You should go to Wizards sometimes with Amelia too because
yeah,
we've got a ton of that stuff. And then they have I think they have an actual, Magic the Gathering nights and stuff over there as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I haven't, gotten into Magic the Gathering since early 90s or whatever.
Yeah, it's been forever. Which, by the way, I do have, I don't mean to cut you off, somewhere at my mom's house, which is now my sister's house, and I cannot find it.
I've looked and looked. Threw everything away.
No, because I still have this like little cubby hole in my old room that is like piled to the ceiling. I guess I need to explain what a cubby hole is. It's like a, there was
not
this
to
weird,
our listeners, you don't.
Well, yeah, that's true. In my room, and then it connects like, I don't know. How would you describe the cubby holes in my old
Here's
room?
What's cool. I probably wouldn't.
Okay. They're like little like mini closets. Anyway, it's somewhere I have a Mox Emerald, a Mox Pearl, like this like little stack of like all my like valuable magic cards. And this was like when it first came out. So they've never been played, and they're somewhere in this like little box. But man, I can't.
You got to get up there, man. And also, going back to your question, I wouldn't describe a cubbyhole as like a mini closet. Although that is kind of a good explanation, I would have said something like, you know, like a shelf.
No, it's not like a shelf. No.
Before we hit the record button when we promised that we would just get straight into this case because it's so dang interesting.
Okay,
and then
fine.
You just went on this tirade about your mini closet full of Magic the Gathering cards at your mom's house.
Just get in there. Get in there.
Look, I feel like I say the same thing every single time when I say, hey, this is one that we've wanted to do for a long time.
Yep.
But it's true. And this is one that I definitely kind of forgot about. I wrote it down in one of the original notebooks. You know, when you mentioned it, like, hey, we need to do, you know, it's almost like this bullet point list of stuff that Tyler's like, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to do this, I want to talk about altitude sickness, whatever it is.
Okay, that's
enough. Well, the patrons will understand that one.
No, by the way, I need to clarify. My asthma was so bad that I forgot my inhaler one day, and they had to put me in the lunchroom freezer.
Well, my God.
I'm telling you, it was like legit. It wasn't just like, oh, I have asthma, I don't want to have pee time.
Yeah. Well, if you want to hear more about Tyler's ailments as a child, make sure that you go check out our Patreon where we have a brand new episode coming out this week.
And it's called Bubble Boy.
We dive deep into Tyler's bubble boyness and also other stuff like manga and everything. Anyway, let me take you back to 1965. The world was certainly a different place back then. Mm-hmm. Just to give you some context here, just a few days before this incident occurred that we're going to talk about, the Beatles released Rubber Soul, one of my favorite albums. On the same date that this incident occurred, December 9th, 1965, A Charlie Brown Christmas first aired on TV.
Which, by the way, do you ever try to like imagine yourself seeing these things that are just so timeless to us now that like, you know, these evergreen things that like come on every year? Like I think about that. I think of like how did a person feel sitting down and seeing that airing for the first time? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, in 1965, you know, I'm sure like animation was still like magic.
Right.
In some respects. And most of these things, it kind of takes you back to the first time you ever saw this, A Charlie Brown's Christmas or Home Alone, all that stuff. It's like, that's why we keep watching it every year. But that's not what we're talking about today, folks. Today, we're talking about the Kecksburg UFO incident. December 9th, 1965, this brilliant light streaked through the sky over Canada. It was also seen over the northeastern United States. Thousands of eyewitnesses reported its trail, which was visible for hundreds of miles in every direction. Many even described it as this huge fireball streaking across the sky. In Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, which is about 40 miles southeast of Pittsburgh, Rob Landy and his brother Ray were outside riding their bicycles.
We were riding up the road and we just happened to look up into the sky and we saw this thing coming over the tops of the trees. It just glided right across the sky, like across the horizon of the trees. We could see and disappeared behind the trees. It scared us. We didn't know what it was or didn't know what to think about it. Just like dumbfounded us. We were just like in awe, you know, as we watched it. And it disappeared and we ran.
And that's a quote from Ray. Here's one from Rob. He said,
"You knew what an airplane looked like. You knew what a helicopter looked like. And that didn't look like anything we had ever seen before. And the angle that it was coming in, I mean, you knew that it had to hit the ground."
Only 3 miles away, another local boy, also named Randy, last name Overly, also reported that he saw the object. And he says,
I was playing by a creek at the time and heard a deep hissing noise. And I looked up in the sky and saw an object coming at me from a pretty good distance away. It flew right over top of me, no higher in the air than 200 feet, and was going no faster than a small airplane would go.
Nevin and Nadine Kalp were also playing outside. And first, let me just say this too. Like I said before, 1965, this is a different time. Mm-hmm. These kids, Charlie Brown is about to be on television.
Yeah.
And these kids are outside playing. It's just super cool.
Which also,
yeah,
not to derail, but when did they decide to like start replaying this every single year?
What are you talking about, Charlie Brown?
Yeah, like I wonder if like it was just like, okay, well, we're in the next year, might as well play it again.
Yeah, we don't really have anything else to occupy the time.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but we could look that up, I'm sure. Nevin and Nadine Kalp were also playing outside when the object flew overhead and crashed in a wooded ravine half a mile away. Nevin says,
this ball of like fire come through. It's something that I've never seen before and never seen since. And seen the smoke then at that time down in the hollow there.
The Kalp farm itself is located less than a mile from Kecksburg Village.
The radio said something had been sighted, and they were calling all around trying to find out if anyone had an airplane or something missing. So I called in and told them it was no airplane. It was just a small piece that had fallen off an airplane because smoke had came up from the area where it landed, and I said it burned up.
Well, it landed right out here near my farm. Yes, it did.
The object appeared to have crashed about a half mile from the Kalp's home.
Hello.
Within a matter of 2 or 3 minutes, I got a call from a man from the U.S. Navy. And he told me that I was to watch the area, should anything strange develop, to call this number.
Shouldn't I call the fire company?
I said, well, shouldn't I call the fire company? And he said, no. You call us, we'll call them. So I hung up from talking to him and went to call a girlfriend of mine, and I didn't get about 2 sentences out to her when an operator came on and cleared the line with an emergency call.
Oh, okay, operator.
That turned out to be the state police.
Within minutes, Pennsylvania state troopers descended on the site. By now, there was no smoke, and the light outside was fading.
At this point, two of the men took a box and went walking towards those trees. And I said to this state trooper that was there, I said, what are all these people coming for? And he said, well, they think they're going to see something. But when this goes out of here, nobody's going to see it. And I said, well, maybe it isn't in here. He said, it's here. And I asked him how he knew. And he said, it's the radiation.
Later, volunteer fireman Jim Mays located the site from an overlook above the ravine. And he said,
we went up this road and came to the brow of a hill and stopped, and down to the right in a hollow were these blue flashing lights. It wasn't searchers down in the woods with flashlights or anything. It was a real bright blue, real bright, like an electric welder.
Which, by the way, I wonder if that blue is like just how we view like LED now. Because if you think about the lights back in that day, they all would have been that sort of quote unquote like warm, you know.
Yeah. Well, like, I mean, any kind of LED light would be different than their sort of like yellow halogen that they're used to.
Yeah, the halogen. Yeah. That's what I was trying to think of. Yeah.
The flashes seemed to be timed at what intervals, I don't know. But it was a time thing. It wasn't like flash bulbs or anything like that. At that point, the troopers decided to close the area off, close the roads off. So he brought the two of us that was with him back to the fire station.
By the way, as you can tell, you know, growing or like living in the South and stuff, I always, it's just funny. Whenever you hear these guys speak, it's like they just sound like Southerners. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Basically, this is my time to get on a soapbox and say, hey, guys, let's stop hating each other. We're all the same, okay?
First of all, did you just say soap bucket?
Soap box, man.
Oh, I thought you said
that
would have
been so funny if I did. All right.
God, that would
so at
been
that
funny.
Point, a call went out to all the local fire departments. I mean, just, you know, 30 volunteer firemen were dispatched from the Kecksburg station. I mean, just imagine, this is a smaller town. Mm-hmm. They don't really, you know, it's 1965. Mm-hmm. This is probably the most action this place has seen since, I don't know what, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so it's
I can say the most famous bit of action is the car that I actually own, which is the 65 Mustang. That was a pretty big deal back in 65. But other than that, people are just hanging out in the woods.
Yep. And all of a sudden, this gigantic ball of fire just flies overhead. You know, the fire department, they're like, man, we got to make sure this thing doesn't spread. Mm-hmm. So the call went out. More than 30 volunteer firemen were dispatched. And volunteer fireman James Romansky was with a search team that actually found the crash site.
Yeah.
And he says...
Which, by the way, before you get into the actual crash, some of the eyewitness accounts, some of the folks that basically saw, you know, had sightings of it moving while it was still in the air, were saying that it was sort of moving at different angles and different directions, like it was a manned... some sort of manned aircraft.
Yeah, different angles, directions, and even more fascinating to me, because, you know, who knows, you know, as an eyewitness, if something moves a little weird, you know, your perception might be off. But here's an important detail that I found fascinating. Different speeds.
Yeah, right.
Slowing up, speeding up. I mean, slowing down, speeding up. Mm-hmm. All right, so James Romansky, this volunteer fireman who, quote unquote, found the crash site, he said,
we all gathered at the fire station, and the report was we had an aircraft that was down in the Kecksburg area. And after we got our assignment and everybody knew what they were doing, they took us in pickup trucks up the road up here, and they dropped us off at certain points going up the hill. As we were proceeding through our grid, we heard the first team, which was down in front of us, radio back, we found the aircraft. Well, man, we booked out of ours and down through over the fence, we went down into the woods, and we got there. Here was this humongous metal object, half buried in the ground, about 6, 7, 8 foot around, and it was every bit of 8, 10, 12 foot long. And to me, the object looked exactly like a fresh acorn that you pick off a tree. There was no wings, there was no motors, there was no propellers. There was no identification whatsoever that were identified as an aircraft that I would know. There was a bumper on the bottom part of it. On that bumper, there was what I call, it looked to me like the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. It was markings like stars and shapes and figures and circles and lines, and what it was, I don't know. To this day, I've never seen anything like it. I've studied the ancient Incas, I've studied the ancient Aztec Indians, I've studied the Egyptians. I've looked at pictures of Russian writing, I've looked at pictures of Polish writing, I've looked at pictures of Hebrew writing, Chinese writing, no, nothing. Nothing that resembles it. So we're all standing around this thing, looking around, checking and everything, and wondering what in the heck it could be. And finally, here come two men down through the woods. And they took one look at the object and immediately told us to leave. They said, this area is now quarantined. We are in charge. We're taking command. Get out of here. So we start walking out of there. Down through the woods, here comes military. So we left there, and by the time we got back down here to the fire hall, I mean, this place was wall-to-wall military.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's a pretty cool place. If you're a Martian.
Or a vampire. Vampire.
You think you really know what's happening around here, don't you?
If anyone out there wants
to. We're fighters for truth, justice, and the American way.
Hey, this is Woody.
And this is Tyler. And you're listening to That Would Be Rad.
And now, back to our show. Now, this is kind of playing out like you would almost expect it to, almost like it was in a movie, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you have this weird ball of fire,
mm-hmm.
instantly followed up by a sort of local authority, which is just like, hey, man, we got to control this situation. They just think it's something that's on fire, possibly a plane. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was interesting that this James guy, because, and we'll talk about later people's different theories or what they say it was. He immediately identifies it as some metal object, not a rock, not a, you know, any kind of meteor, a metal object, right? With, and again, an interesting detail, these Egyptian-like hieroglyphics. Did I say that weird? Hieroglyphics.
No.
I said hieroglyphics, I think. Egyptian hieroglyphics and markings on the bottom side of it. And then, of course, who rolls in? Military.
Yeah, like immediately, which I find sort of telling, if you will. You
telling,
know?
But also they're in multiple ways. Number one, and I don't know, will you do this research as I'm saying this? Like, what are the close by military bases or the closest? As you're looking at that, to me,
it
kind of
Wright-Patterson?
Maybe. There's also one in Ohio that I think that's where they say they're from.
I think that's what I'm thinking of.
Okay. And I don't know what the mileage there is, but if it's not too long after this thing's crashed, to me that says they knew it was coming.
Well, the interesting thing too is, so yeah, Wright-Patterson is in Ohio, which is interesting because that's also the base that, you know, if you believe in the urban legend of the Roswell crash, which to our listeners that don't know about this, we eventually will definitely do. It's sort of the grandfather of all UFO crash retrieval stories. And we will do a full episode, maybe probably a two-parter. But the myth that surrounds it is that the craft was recovered or the wreckage. And then from there, it was flown to Wright-Patterson. So a lot of people believe that, like, what we've always thought of, like Area 51 and all that, and like, oh, they have like spaceships and stuff. It's kind of like within these sort of conspiracy circles that like the real Area 51 and the real place where all this stuff is like kept was Wright-Patterson.
Yeah. And just for like distance context here, Kecksburg is about a 3 to 4 hour drive to Columbus, Ohio, where Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is.
So like a, like, it would be there in no time if you were flying.
Right. But if these military units are coming in with vehicles and everything, they had to have been, like, a closer local military base, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Pittsburgh, I think, is 40 miles southeast of Pittsburgh. So presumably, maybe they could be there within the hour. But again, I just feel like, to me, the first thing I think of is, like, oh, man, they saw this big object coming via, like, radar or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew something was about to happen. Even if it was a meteor, okay, they're there for a reason. And in 1965, you're still pretty close to that window of a lot of, you know, Roswell, yeah. a lot of these things sort of happening that would alert. I mean, God, it wasn't even until 1969. So like 4 years later that like MUFON was
right.
founded, right? And so like right. you're still in the early stages of like, even if it was a meteor, yeah, there might be a military presence there just to make sure, hey, what are we, you know, what is this?
Well, and also, I mean, if you look at like Jalen Hynek and like Project Blue Book, that was like mid to late 50s. So, you know, I think even though, you know, to the public, the quote unquote like government or military, I guess technically at that time, would say, oh, there's nothing to see here. Move along. It was a barn owl. It was a meteor, blah, blah, blah. But in reality, we know that there was a lot of money. There were big budgets, like sort of, you know, put into these, I don't know, put into this exploration of like these, you know, quote unquote, like flying saucers or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, especially I think I'm glad that you sort of prefaced with, you know, sightings through Canada originally, mm-hmm. which means, you know, they would have been probably tracking it a long way. So that's how they were right. able to get there so fast.
Yeah.
Another thing that's interesting that I don't know if you're going to get to, but the apparently the two men, which I mean, again, this is like right out of a movie, the two men that basically were kind of leading the charge and they were dispersing the locals were said to be wearing black and white business suits with trench coats.
Hold on. Yeah, we're going to get there. Just a second.
Okay, okay.
Well, there's some other stuff too, speaking of how they were dressed. Okay, so let's dive back in. So this volunteer firefighter, he's down there at the crash site. Pretty soon, these folks come down out of the woods, these two guys, those that you're talking about, I guess, dressed up like potentially men in black, I think is what you're alluding to. And he's like, all right, well, these guys are in charge. He drives back to the station that he referred to as the fire hall, which is about as old school as it gets there.
Yeah.
And he said it's just covered up in military.
Yeah.
An hour later, military authorities took over a farmhouse near the ravine owned by a lady named Lillian Hayes. And she said,
well, the military was coming in and out of my house all evening. They were making a lot of phone calls and they were standing around in groups talking. I have no idea who they telephoned. There was no calls turned up on my bill.
Whoa. I mean, can you imagine just, I think it's also important to kind of set out like just what sort of the zeitgeist was at that time. Like the fact that the average citizen had so much faith in their government, in their military, in their sort of patriotic duty, if you will, that like men can just show up and within an hour, your house is full of soldiers and they're just using your phone. And you're just like, hey, I'm cool with it. You know, it's my patriotic duty to let these people commandeer my house.
Right, right.
Like, yeah, that's crazy.
It's weird, yeah. Although, like, at the same time, it's like, I don't know. It's she's probably super fearful of what it could be. Although I'm sure that they're, like, calming her down. At the same time, they're like, you know, we just want to keep you safe, you know. 19-year-old guy named Bill Weaver was 19 and was one of the many spectators who tried to come in and sort of do what we would do, which is like take a peek, see what's going on. And he says,
I happened to come down through Kecksburg and I heard on the radio that an object had landed. Seeing some people and some cars alongside the road, I pulled in. There was a pretty good crowd of people gathered in that field. And they were looking down into a small ravine, some trees. I looked down in there myself. I seen there was something down in there that had bright lights on it. But I couldn't see the object itself. Sometime later, I seen a box truck, a van-type truck, pull up there. There were some men come around the side of it. They were dressed in moon suits, we called them at the time. And they had a light-colored box, I'm guessing roughly 5 foot square. They carried it down into the ravine. They told me unless I moved my car and got out of there that they would confiscate my car.
Back at the Kecksburg Fire Station, James Romansky, that same volunteer firefighter from before, and the other volunteers waited for orders.
We looked up, and here comes this Jeep down over the hill with its red light on. Right behind the Jeep was a large flatbed truck. And on the back of the flatbed was this covered object. They come down here so fast that I know if you'd have walked out in front of it, they'd have ran you over. They'd have never stopped. And out down the road they went. Where they went, I have no idea.
Now, that whole scene kind of brings to mind Flight of the Navigator.
Yeah, right.
Right? Like, they've got the ship, they're covering it with this tarp, and they're just driving it down the road.
Mm-hmm.
UFO researcher Stan Gordon believes the government knows what happened. And here he says,
whatever came down in Kecksburg that night is of high importance to the military agencies. The most mysterious thing about the whole case is the fact that after 25 years, the government still refuses to give us any actual information on what occurred.
Now, obviously, this interview with Stan Gordon, you know, was 25 years after 1965, which is, when that, 1990? Is that right? No.
Yeah, it was probably for his, like, so Stan Gordon's kind of a legend. He did a documentary in the 90s. I think you can rent it on Prime. But he's like a big UFO researcher. You see him a lot in like these sort of, you know, UFO shows and stuff. But he, oddly enough, he was already kind of intrigued by the topic. And so he lived in the area. He was 16 at the time. And he's kind of made it kind of his life's mission to, you know, take this like this, his local UFO case and pretty much try to interview like any and every person that had anything to do with it, heard anything, seen anything. And I think that's really cool for like just to have the sort of historical record, because, you know, especially now, most of those people are long gone, you know.
Stan Gordon at the time interviewed dozens of Kecksburg eyewitnesses, just like you were saying, and he's also examined a lot of different theories. He says,
astronomers who looked into the case at the time basically felt that the object in question was a bolide, which was a very bright fireball-type meteor. And they, in fact, eliminated reports that it could have been some type of man-made device that re-entered the Earth's atmosphere. But we now know the thing basically was coming down from the tip of Ontario and was passing down basically in a northwest to southeast trajectory. The object appeared to have made about a 25-degree turn toward the east, near Cleveland, Ohio. And it came in on a straight path over the Pittsburgh area. And the interesting thing is now that the new data suggests that the object made a turn towards the south. And then the object made another turn towards the village of Kecksburg, where it was proceeding into there towards the northeast. The interesting thing is the fact that within several miles of the crash site, multiple witnesses tell us that this object was coming in at a very, very slow speed of descent. Meteors do not make controlled turns. They do not come in at a slow speed like this. And they, in fact, do not glide in, which this thing apparently did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like what we were saying earlier, it's like making maneuvers and slowing down and...
Yeah.
You know, it's wild, man.
Yeah, it really is.
This guy named Jim Mays is, you know, at the time when they recorded this interview, was still baffled by what fell from the sky that night. He says,
my personal opinion of what landed in Kecksburg that night was a capsule of some kind. From where, whether it was one of ours or a foreign, I have no idea. The military wouldn't let us get to the scene. So I have no idea, but I know it wasn't a meteor.
Another theory put forth by Stan Gordon is that the object was space debris. The government has always monitored not only U.S. space activity, but also launches from other countries. And Stan says,
going back into the records we have from NASA and documents we have from other agencies, they apparently have no loggings for any type of space debris on that date and the time of this observation. So we also have to look at the other possibility. Could this indeed have been in an extraterrestrial spacecraft?
Stan Gordon obtained, through the Freedom of Information Act, the official Air Force record of the Kecksburg incident. And he says,
the report indicated that there was quite a lot of interest by government agencies as to what the object may have been. There were memos there and requests for information from Houston Space Center, from NORAD, from the Air Force Command Post, the Pentagon, even the chairman of the Office of Emergency Planning requested information. The official Air Force explanation was that it was likely a meteor. And basically what it goes on to say is the fact that the search was called off around 2 a.m. and that nothing was found. But evidence indicates that something indeed was found at the site.
Which, you know, is interesting that that's what they're saying in these official reports. And I just looked, and I think the report that I have from the Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, it's just in case you guys want to look it up, it's volume 61, page 184. It actually came out. And so the title of the article itself is the report is The Fireball of December 9, 1965. And what's interesting, dude, after hearing Stan Gordon say that about how, there was no data about anything flying around or anything like that, this, you know, at the time, this report came out in 1967. So it's interesting to me because at the time when all this went down, I bet they're like, oh yeah, you guys see some?
Yeah.
We didn't see anything. And then in 1967, probably after a lot of people were poking and prodding, all of a sudden now the Canadian, you know, because there's really crappy, grainy film, pictures of people who had taken pictures of the quote-unquote fireball flying through the sky.
Yeah.
And they even have, like, really cool diagrams of the trajectory and all this. It's just interesting that already there's some contradictory sort of information there.
Yeah. I think, too, you know, we just to sort of interject about, like, just the overall kind of scene here, I think one of the things that is so common in like these old school cases is it's just the idea that, like, you know, the quote unquote like government, like the brass or like the, you know, military or whatever, they do seem to kind of come in, I mean, and or, you know, men in black type characters, you know, they show up to these scenes where, you know, UFOs or, I mean, or any even kind of weird like paranormal kind of stuff, like even the Flatwoods Monster stuff. It's like they kind of come on the scene and they shut everything down and then it kind of disappears, you know. Even with like Roswell, like we stated before, you know, it was a clear kind of thing that happened. It was on the radio, it's on the news, and then suddenly, you know, a day goes by or 2 days goes by and it's like, oh, it was just this, nothing to see here, move on. And they kind of shut it down. But I think with this particular case, and why it's so interesting is the fact that you had so many eyewitnesses and so many people that were like physically on the scene that actually got a look of like this, you know, said UFO.
Right.
Which is fascinating.
And like a thing that kind of like adds to the credibility in my opinion. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You've got a lot of like townsfolk that, let's just say for a second, maybe that it was a meteor or a fireball, whatever. They all see this thing. No big, you know, surprise there. But then you've got this guy who shows up at the scene. If you're a volunteer firefighter or even just, you know, paid on whatever, you might think, holy crap, this is an aircraft. We might have to rescue somebody.
Yeah, right.
You're getting
right
down in there. And then he sees this metal object with these hieroglyphics. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And that's another thing, too, that is fairly common. Like, I don't know. I think it is fascinating, the idea of like Egyptian hieroglyphs being found on this stuff. I mean, again, I mean, you know, it is funny how many things like sort of tie in together, like the Roswell crash, 1947, you know, you have some of the, you know, one of the urban legends is that like in the wreckage was found like this like little sort of purplish metal rod, and on the rod was what looked like hieroglyphs. Hmm. And so, and I think the, I want to say like maybe the, I could, this could totally be wrong, but I think like the Rendlesham Forest incident over in England, mm-hmm. I think that there were, they also saw hieroglyphs on
was that
one.
Like
early
70s?
I think so. Or maybe they were like sort of downloaded information when they got close to it, and they were seeing hieroglyphs in their mind.
Something like that. There's this like weird sort of symbology maybe, or what's it called, man? I don't know. But these symbols and stuff that they're seeing.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I mean, you know, is it like an extraterrestrial thing, or is it, I mean, I do kind of like the idea that, you know, maybe there is a link with more sort of like ancient culture. Like it kind of gets to that, mm-hmm. you know, lost history kind of stuff.
Yeah. So Bill Weaver was one of the eyewitnesses, and this kind of comes back to that credibility standpoint. And he said,
"The military's idea of finding nothing is completely false. There was something down in that ravine that night. There was something that glowed an awful bright light. And they took something out of there that night."
We'll return after these messages.
Something out there waiting for us.
Hey, this is Bryce Johnson from the Bigfoot Collectors Club, and you're listening to Tyler and Woody on That Would Be Rad, because that is rad.
Many of the eyewitnesses reported seeing the military convoy coming out of this ravine. Mm-hmm. John Hayes, who was only 10 years old when this flatbed truck with a large covered object on the back rumbled by his bedroom window, and he said,
"What was on the back of it, I have no idea. It was about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle from the distance I was at."
According to Stan Gordon, eyewitnesses identified the military unit as an Air Force radar squadron based in Pittsburgh. Gordon believes the unit was a part of a top secret operation investigating UFOs.
"There is no entry at all for December 9th of 1965 in the December log of all activities for that squadron. That tells us that somebody apparently wanted to keep all information associated with the unit's involvement in that site away from public information. I think that we can very plainly see the fact that the government has not told us everything they know about the Kecksburg case."
Going back to James Romanski, this volunteer fireman, he says he doesn't believe the government reports. In fact, he says,
"Official reports that the military and the government put out, as far as I'm concerned, are a bunch of bull."
Tell him, James.
Mm-hmm. "If this thing was a meteorite, then why didn't they just bring it out and say, here it is, let the reporters take pictures of it, let the firemen see it, let the people in this area see it? Why the big mystery?"
Yeah, that's a great point.
That's an outstanding point, man.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, that would be much easier, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, and also it would, like, you would think that it would, because, you know, as a government official, you're going to know that, like, this is going to start this sort of, you know, thing. And, I mean, you know, the term flying saucer was created, mm-hmm. you know, Kenneth Arnold in the 40s. And so we're kind of well into, you know, the... I don't know, like
it's
the space
the cultural,
age sort
yeah,
of,
yeah, yeah.
You know, and so like you could see like, oh, well, let's go ahead and like shut this down before it turns into a thing. Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and like show, I mean, even like with Roswell where they put out like a newspaper with like the, you know, military guy holding the weather balloon. It's mm-hmm. like you would think they would at least do something like that.
Right. And it, like he said, if it was a meteor, it's like, man, it couldn't even be easier. Just, here we go, take a picture, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Stan Gordon kind of concludes,
I think when we get down to eliminating everything we've known about the object, we have two possibilities we're dealing with here. Either one, that we're dealing with some highly advanced space probe, probably of a foreign nation, that appears to be very highly technical for what we knew about 1965. Or the possibility exists that we may indeed be dealing with an extraterrestrial spacecraft.
Yeah. Now, that's an interesting piece that, although, sure, I guess I would list it in the list of possibilities, but it's just one that I don't really think about that often. But yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess technically it could be some sophisticated sort of, Chinese or Korean spy craft.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I'm some volunteer firefighter in 1965 in some rural Pennsylvania town, wouldn't I potentially consider the Korean language to be the closest thing I could think of would be, you know, hieroglyphics?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so sure, that's a possibility.
Which, by the way, I think since then, apparently Romanski, I mean, you got to think like how big of a deal that would be and how, you know, an event like that could really change someone's life. So apparently he, in the Stan Gordon documentary, he, you know, interviews him, and I think they've remained friends their whole life. And apparently through Romanski's life, he, you know, became fascinated with this and has spent hours upon hours, like, looking into, you know, what these symbols or iconography could be. And he thinks that it's somewhere between like Egyptian and Cyrillian, I think is what he's sort of come up with. And, you know, again, that is a, I wouldn't say common, but that is an aspect of like old school ufology that, you know, people would see. So I think, I mean, there's definitely something there, whether
you mean
it was,
like, the symbols and stuff.
Yeah. The symbols found on these, you know, advanced like spacecraft or,
yeah,
or ships. Or
and I'm not sure when this became popular or how, and I'm sure you do know this, but there is that connection, obviously, between, like, you know, aliens and Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. at least in, you know, pop culture, but also, like, I'm sure there's a dozen History Channel shows about that.
Yeah.
It's interesting, if you really think about, like, the Egyptian language and stuff, right? Or at least, like, the written language and the hieroglyphics and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It, like, it goes from that and then evolves into, like, things like Sanskrit and, like,
yeah,
it's almost like, hey, what's the easiest way to communicate with somebody that doesn't speak the same language, right? Let's say you are stranded on an island and mm-hmm. there's another person there. They don't speak English. You're trying to tell them, hey, man, you know, have you seen any animals or anything? What are you going to do? You're not going to write the word deer. You're going to draw a picture.
Yeah, it's like a petroglyph, basically.
Right. And so it's
which
like,
is kind of like the earliest comic book.
Well, there you go.
If you look at it in that sense, yeah.
Is it possible that the hieroglyphics that we know of to be Egyptian were just like sort of that sort of almost like a handed down language? To almost like in a universal sense so that they could communicate with whomever showed them that language?
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, I mean, it kind of gets into like a book called Chariot of the Gods or Chariots of the Gods or even like some Graham Hancock. And it is interesting. You look at like the Egyptians in like that sort of first era, everything was like so sort of advanced and, you know, like technologically advanced, like all the building was so much better. And then it was almost like there was this other age where it was almost like this other age just sort of co-opted like what was already there in a way. So it was almost like it was like dumbed down, and you can tell that like there was something happened to where whoever took that over, like they were basically, instead of continuing on this legacy of, you know, advancements in like the written language and all that kind of stuff, it was almost like they were just sort of graffitiing over that. And so I think that is interesting. And I do think that like there is something there, whether it's, you know, I've heard like, you know, big on this like Nephilim kick lately, but you know, maybe it was this more advanced, like, you know, maybe it's extraterrestrial, maybe it's like angels, maybe it's whatever, mm-hmm. or fallen angels. But there, something was kind of like handed down, I would say, mm-hmm. you know, in some respect. And it is interesting that, like, you're seeing that. I think the interesting thing to us, I mean, I guess, like, maybe Stargate was the first time that we would have, like, seen anything like this, you know, as kids, yeah. where you had these, like, super advanced, like, sort of futuristic concepts of, like, UFOs, you know, which you think of, like, you know, 50s sci-fi, you think of, like, you know, there's no seams, no bolts. Mm-hmm. It's very technologically advanced. But then you place this thing, which is, like, ancient, like, Egyptian hieroglyphs on it. And it's just really, it's a really cool, like, juxtaposition. So, yeah, it's fascinating, but it's also, it is weird.
Yeah. And, I mean, I don't know how everybody feels about the movie Stargate, but I freaking love it, man.
Oh, yeah.
I remember when it came out, I thought that it was just such a cool concept mm-hmm. that it really kind of, I don't want to say demystifies, but, like, anytime there's that sort of, and again, this sounds silly to say it, but, like, a more realistic reason and or ability to mm-hmm. explain space travel, quote unquote space travel, like yeah. when there's a portal involved, dude, then it's like, oh yeah, then the ships don't have to, you know, it's not light speed, it's something entirely different, yeah. and that explains how these superior beings came mm-hmm. here. And I loved how, like, the big, like, helmets and stuff, the costumes that they would wear is what ended up being, like, how they would draw these Egyptian,
yeah, it's, you like know, the pharaoh, oh,
dude,
pharaohs.
So cool, man.
Yeah, it is cool. It's really cool too to see, like, which I mean is pretty brilliant art direction. It's that idea that, like, you know, we sort of have viewed these things as, like, you know, you look at, like, Osiris and, like, Ra, and, like, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, they have, like, the head of, like, a falcon, or this one has, like, the head of, like, you know, like, these sort of different animals which look like sort of like these gods, which, again, I think it's probably closer to, like, a Nephilim kind of thing mm-hmm. once you start looking into that, you know, like Fomorians and along those lines. But I do think it was really cool in Stargate that, like, oh, they're not actually, like, these weird half animal yeah. gods. Those are just, like, they're like space helmets.
Yeah, dude. So
that's
cool.
Really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I really, really like that. Yeah. Kind of some more interesting details that I found on this. Because, by the way, there was a Unsolved Mysteries episode about this way back when we were kids. I don't remember what the year is that it came out. I'll get that in a second. But on their website, Unsolved Mysteries, there's, like, a comment section. And some of it is, like, from people who witnessed it commenting, you know?
Oh, that was a thing, by the way. I recently heard, I mean, they're pretty long-winded like us, but they do a great job, and that's another podcast called Astonishing Legends. They're awesome. We're huge fans of those mm-hmm. guys, but they do, apparently, I think they covered this and they had a guest on and there was some issues with that particular guest, so they got rid of that episode, but then they sort of revisited the topic and then they brought on Stan Gordon.
Whoa.
And I believe Romanski himself.
Wow.
And he's, like, talking about it, and yeah, it's really interesting. So definitely check
it
out.
Yeah, I want to check that out.
Yeah.
This guy on the site says, I swear on my daughter, I saw this UFO in the sky right by my home. Now, he's from North Fork Road, Pine Grove, West Virginia, which, by the way, dude.
There you go.
I don't know if y'all, like, West Virginia, Pennsylvania,
yeah.
these areas, dude, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And maybe that's something that we can try to uncover at some point.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, dude, these are, like, extreme hotspots for all kinds of crazy stuff. And it's just like, man, I love it. It's incredible. This comment says that, I noticed that you said the Air Force officials who ran off the volunteer firemen were actually observing the object. They were from the 662 radar squadron. But if you Google it, they don't exist.
Yeah.
However, she says, I found a picture of which I took screenshots of a patch for sale on eBay for this exact radar squadron.
Ooh.
She says, now I realize it could be fake, but it looked authentic in the picture and true to the age it would be now. I'm not really forming an opinion one way or the other because I'm skeptical, but open-minded. And it's just an observation I wanted to point out. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to be selling 662 radar squadron patches, but at the same time...
I mean, that's amazing.
I mean, we might have to.
Yeah, we definitely are. That's amazing. I mean, that's kind of like some... I'm not saying this is what it is, but it's like some Mandela effect style, like residue, I guess it's called.
Yeah. Of course, you know, this person whose screen name, by the way, or I guess their screen name, I don't really know, but is Mulder, which is so cool. Mm-hmm. And they say it was probably something Soviet in nature. They couldn't show it off because the press and people would take pictures of it, plus eyewitness reports, etc. They are slash were supposed to ship it back to the Soviet Union back in the day per the agreement between the two nations. I'm not sure what Mulder's talking about here, but that's crazy. Then check this out, bro. This is actually going to set you up nicely. This was posted on July 13th, 2015 by someone that called themselves Anonymous, and it says, "The Kecksburg UFO, I believe, is a German time machine from World War II from the 19 secret German labs discovered in Lower Poland."
Yeah, that's a... this is a topic that is definitely not new. I thought I had sort of discovered this thing, when in reality, you know, in doing some digging, it's already sort of been proposed. But the idea is that, well, I don't know how much I should go into this because it does kind of get into like my thoughts on what all of this is, but I'll be short. Basically, it's the idea that Germany, you know, had been originally working on some anti-gravity type ships, like UFOs, and they're called like the Die Glock or the Die Glock, I guess it's spelled, and often referred to as like the Nazi Bell. And so basically it was this sort of bell-shaped UFO thing that had a type of anti-gravity propulsion system that didn't require, it didn't require like rocket-fueled propulsion. And this gets into another topic. We're not going to do it here, but it does get into a topic that kind of relates, I guess, to a topic that we covered years back in an episode about the Sonora Aero Club here in the U.S., but it's this other group called NYMZA, which is N-Y-M-Z-A, which was this sort of Prussian, which would become Germany, group that would send basically people to the U.S., and they were supposed to kind of, you know, some people think they were spies. I don't know. There's a lot of conjecture back and forth, but it was this idea that they were supposed to, you know, kind of see what we were up to regarding like craft, you know, spacecraft, flight, all that kind of stuff. And then the idea is that those people went back, and then those are the scientists and the people that would go on to take part in creating this Nazi Bell technology, which then, and I mean, this does kind of get, if you know where I'm going, this kind of gives up what I think about it, but this goes on to sort of inspire, because we know through Project Paperclip, you know, after World War II, we take on, you know, we took all of those Nazi scientists. I mean, not all of them, but I think we split them between us and I think France and Italy. But we had like a large bulk of these Nazi scientists who are geniuses, but I mean, they're still Nazis at the end of the day. Werner von Braun, to speak of, and that was Project Paperclip, and that goes on to create NASA, you know, which in turn, you know, goes to like the moon mission in 1969. So, yeah, I think that this Nazi Bell, which looks surprisingly similar to an acorn-shaped craft that we see here in Kecksburg, I think they're pretty close in nature.
Yeah, I mean, they look... I mean, really, really similar. Here's something crazy, dude. Speaking of synchronicity, I've been flipping through a lot of our sort of typical books that we break out. The Tobin Spirit Guide, you know, the Where the Footprints End, Passport to Magonia, Mysteries of the Unexplained, all these books that I have on the shelves. And this one, the by Jerome Clark, The Unidentified or whatever. As you were talking about this, no joke, I was just like, well, let me just... open this. Not that I wasn't listening to you, because I was, and this is why it's significant. I open it up, And it's talking about this dude. I mean, this is just nuts, man. You know, it's going to kind of go into a little bit of what you're talking about here, though.
Mm. We will return after these messages.
America's future can be determined by our dreams and our visions.
It was very intense, bright light.
For over 200 years, there have been reports of giant, man-like creatures.
From another dimension, another world, I don't know.
The most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
This is Joshua Cutchin, and you're at my home for weirdness. That would be rad.
It says, since the last part of the 18th century of adventurers have traveled aloft in balloons, an often dangerous mode of transportation because the aeronaut was at the mercy of the elements, a sudden, unexpected gust of wind could be, and often was, fatal to these pioneers. In 1851, an engine-powered, egg-shaped craft called the dirigible was tested for the first time. Not until 1885, though, could it be maneuvered in the air. Again, we talk about this when we talked about the flap and the aero club and stuff.
Yep. And the airship mystery.
The airship.
Yeah.
And we kind of talked about it in... Go ahead, sir.
I totally do not believe that. I think we had these dirigibles much, and like these, you know, quote unquote, like airships. I think we had this stuff far, far earlier.
Check this out. Well, it's funny that you say that because, you know, we were talking about, what is that, 1851, yada, yada, yada. It says, you know, another one took place in France in 1903. I think we talked about that case also, or that event also in that episode. Mm. And then it says that dirigibles did not appear in the United States until 1904 when Thomas Scott Baldwin tested his California Aero in August of that year. It says, but nothing in the early history of flight tells us just what a huge airborne cigar was doing over New Mexico in 1880.
Yeah.
Especially when it, quote, appeared to be entirely under the control of the occupants and appeared to be guided by a large fan-like apparatus.
Which, by the way, they called those ghost ships. The cigar, like the early, or like the mid to early 1800s. Craft. There were a lot that was like sort of in that airship flap, but they called those, the ones that were shaped like cigars, they called those the ghost ships, which is pretty fascinating.
That is pretty cool. Now, going back to what you were saying in terms of, you know, connecting the Kecksburg UFO to potentially the, what's it called? The Nazi Bell.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And this connection of airships of any sort with us and the Germans. Check this out. During the 1850s, mysterious airships, in quotes, regularly crossed the skies of Germany, saddling the latter 19th century with what would prove to be one of its most recurrent, baffling problems. And it was just before that, around the year of 1848, that a remarkable, enigmatic young German named C.A.A. Delschau immigrated to the United States. So, I could go further, man, but I just found it interesting that as you were talking about this, I'm literally seeing, and this guy, Delschau or whatever, I just kind of skimmed through this. Extremely fascinating.
I thought, did we not cover this?
I mean, maybe a little bit, dude, but I mean, this is, we're talking about a guy who, he was like, from his own sort of journals and testimony, we know that he was in Sonora, California during the 1850s. Then, dude, decades after that, no idea. Mm-hmm. Then he ends up in Houston, Texas, and didn't really have any friends, didn't really, you know, dismiss sort of as an eccentric. You know, dude, I mean, the more I'm kind of reading into this, he died in 1924. Well, I think this guy's a time traveler.
Well, the thing that's fascinating about Delschau is, I swear, I think we covered this. If we didn't, it was an episode that we planned on covering and then just... that pivoted. But yeah, Charles Delschau is the reason that we know about the Sonora Aero Club. And it was basically this club of like financiers and like rich men. And, you know, a lot of them were like scientists and explorers and like really like pretty cool. You know, they were like on the cusp of like technology and, you know, because I guess when we think of like flight and technology as U.S. citizens, we immediately think of like military or NASA. And it's like, but these guys were like in the private sector and they were like
Elon Musk.
Kind of. Yeah. Kind of the same thing. And the only reason that we even know about the Sonora Aero Club is basically because of this guy. They, and again, this was like years later in like the, I don't know, I think the 50s or 60s, like a junk dealer ran across like a chest of like these 12 notebooks. And these notebooks are just filled with Delschaux's drawings of all these aeroglyphs. And he has like all these writings. And like in his writings, he basically says that like he was never one of like the pilots, but he was like the, what was it? He was like a clerk and a,
What is it? Let me just do this just to get, because I think what we need to do is we need to kind of give whatever our final sort of opinion about Kecksburg is. But before we do that, I'm going to make a grand statement here so that we don't pivot. We're going to talk about Delschaux next week, but let me give a little teaser right now. Is that okay?
Yeah, dude.
So looking at these, like they call them in this book, scrapbooks that they found, it says at least one thing was obvious. Delschaux was one of two minds about his project. On one hand, he wanted his, quote, secrets known. On the other, he was afraid to speak too directly for reasons we shall get to shortly, it says. So he compromised and wrote in a fashion aimed at discouraging all but the most determined student. Still, Delschaux left much unanswered. Actually, in a very real sense, he left everything unanswered. Yeah. He was writing for an audience, if not one in his own day, then one at some point in the future. He addressed potential readers like this. You will, Wonder Weaver, you will unriddle these writings. They are my stock of open knowledge. They will end, like all others, with good intentions, but too weak-willed to assign and put to work. According to his notes, in the 1850s, and here we go, he and a group of associates, about 60 in all, gathered in Sonora, California, where they formed the Aero Club and constructed and flew heavier-than-air machines. And I'm just going to leave it right there.
Yeah.
Because it goes on, and, dude, this is really, really cool stuff.
Yeah, and also, there's also, and this is weird, and it's even just this name is divisive, but there's also a possible link to Trump, to the Aero Club, or the Trump family at least, or maybe even just the name alone, which is kind of interesting when you know sort of the story. And that'll, we'll get more into that also in this next episode. But yeah, it is fascinating. And as we're getting back to the Kecksburg case, I think it's safe to say that, number one, we, or at least I for sure, do not believe. I've gotten to the point where I don't really believe a lot of what we were sort of taught in school, as far as like, oh, well, you just had the Wright brothers, and they basically had these, like, they were flapping wings on a hill, and they were, I think all that stuff is so dumb. I mean, especially, like, I don't know, especially with these sort of documents that, you know, that you find regarding, like, this highly, highly advanced, like, possible Nazi technology, you know, and then the Aero Club, and then the NIMSA stuff. You know, and like the even just the airship flap, which we've covered. I think the story that we've been sold is just, I don't know, it's just kind of laughable, really. But I do think that there is something interesting in, maybe it wasn't the same craft per se, but I think the technology was going hand in hand with like the Nazi Bell and the Kecksburg Acorn, as it's, you know, referred to sometimes.
And I encourage everybody, and we'll, of course, post a picture of it, but the resemblance, or at least like the similarities between this acorn-shaped thing that fell in, or landed, I should say, in Kecksburg, and this Nazi Bell are interesting. And I think there's all kinds of theories about the Bell itself being potentially a time machine. You know, it's not just a craft in terms of, you know, flying, I think physically. Some of the theories are that it's, you know, made to sort of travel in space and time and that kind of thing, which is interesting.
Well, one of the things about that particular topic, and I don't know, I think that I'm not totally sold on the, like, the time machine aspect of it. Like, I think it's really cool, but I think that came from a place of, oh, well, this thing doesn't have wings. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's not a rock. It's not, like, sort of rocket-fueled propulsion. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look like a missile or, you know, ballistics-type object. So maybe it's, like, something else. Maybe this technology. But I don't know. I mean, you know, hindsight's 2020, obviously. And we look back at, you know, if you believe...
they put a man on the moon.
Yeah. You know, if you believe, like, you know, some of the whistleblowers throughout the years, which I just, like Bob Lazar, for example, you know, the way that he explained how these crafts that, you know, we were sort of working on that could have possibly been back engineered from, you know, wreckage from, like, Roswell and stuff, you know, it's almost like creating this sort of gravity wave where it would create its own gravity. And so it's basically sort of, you know, how we can, like, drop a ball to the ground, it's basically creating its own field of gravity where it's continually, like, falling forward. And that's how it's, like, that's how, like, the propulsion is, like, working. So I think that's really interesting. And I think, you know, obviously there's no direct propulsion, there's no wings, there's nothing to, like, no sort of guidance. I think whatever these things are, they're, you know, for sure kind of advanced. Also, one of the things, and not getting too far into it, but one of the things about the Sonora Aero Club is that the fueling, which I think is called, like, I'll have to, like, go back and look more into this for next week's episode, but I think it was called, like, NB fuel or like SUPA, they even called it. And that's sort of, like, the mystery that I think died, you know, when the Sonora Aero Club kind of, like, disbanded. And then the head guy, like, passed away. Like, the whatever that fuel was that was, like, creating, like, the propulsion system, like, that secret disappeared. I mean, at least as far as we know.
Yeah.
Who knows?
What's, like, an interesting thing about the sort of Bob Lazar take of propulsion and stuff and the mechanism involved, to me, I've always thought, ever since I learned that, it's like, dude, you got these gigantic, I mean, think about who basically loses the most, if that exists. Well, I mean, fuel companies, right? I mean, there's so much money tied into, you know, oil and gas and all that. You could monetize the ability to, like, manipulate gravity and stuff just with the technology. And then after that, it's like, it's kind of like, you know, the technology to, you know, make these electric vehicles. At first, it's really expensive, but then as time goes on and as the patents kind of become public and, you know, all that kind of stuff, then other people can duplicate it. I think it's pretty awesome that Musk was like, no, it's public information. You guys can make it too if you want.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
So, I, like, mean, and that's such a parallel to the original Tesla, Nikola Tesla, who, you know, that was his big thing. Is he had basically, the story goes that, like, he knew of how to create, like, free energy. Some people think that it was, like, cold fusion based, but that's the idea of, like, oh, well, you know, why don't we have free energy? Because, of course, it's going to hurt the people who are benefiting the most, like, you know, oil and gas and all that stuff. And to me, in the modern age, the people that are getting hurt the most also are, you know, you look at NASA, and they make billions upon billions per year. And I don't know. I kind of think, like, these rocket-fueled crafts are just a front for the public. I think we're far, far beyond having to use gas propulsion, basically. But that's just my two cents.
I feel like I was going to say something else about this. I mean, ultimately, I think this is a really cool classic case. I find it super fascinating that I couldn't find it in any of my freaking books. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know. They might just have it listed as something else, but I don't know. To me, this is up there with, you know, I mean, I think of, you know, Flatwoods Monster, even the same kind of thing where it's like this strange ball of fire in the air. They go down and check it out. I mean, I don't think there was anything in terms of any beings or anything being seen.
Maybe
that's what they took away in that box, dude.
Well, so here's the thing. So, and I guess we've kind of reached the end of the story somewhat. So there have been, so Stan Gordon, again, you know, like I said, he's a UFO researcher. He's, you know, in the field of like cryptids and paranormal, you know, anything paranormal. But his main sort of life's work is this Kecksburg case. And, you know, he's the guy responsible for like the Kecksburg, like the UFO like festival. It's like a 3-day festival they have every year, which, man, we got to get up there. Mm-hmm. It'd be awesome. But, you know, throughout the years, he's had like tons and tons of interviews with these people. And there are a few cases where they've talked about some really odd things. So one of the things is, you know, obviously your two Men in Black type characters. There's another interview where he interviewed this guy who, I think it was around 1 a.m. and the main semi truck, you know, the big flatbed on the back, like it had already left that dirt road, which I do find it interesting that now that road is called Meteor Road. Mm-hmm. I think that's, I don't know, that's a little telling, but apparently there was actually a second truck. And the interesting thing is, and there actually were a few people that saw this second truck pull out. It pulled out, and apparently there were several, how do they explain it? There were several like suitcase sized objects like on the back of this truck, which was really weird. This particular guy though that I'm talking about, and I haven't seen his documentary. I really wanted to watch it like before we started, but I didn't get a chance to, but a lot of this stuff may be in there. But apparently there's this weird sort of account where this eyewitness was like a younger dude back in the day. He ends up seeing this guy down, you know, they had already, I guess, taken out the acorn, the craft. And there's another guy that's like down in the woods, and he says he was dressed like a politician. I think that's sort of an interesting point.
Yeah.
But he said he's holding like what looks like a billy club, like this sort of like rod, and something about like his like arm stretching, like what looked like 9 feet. And he said it looked like, you know, later he would have kids, and he said it looked almost like silly putty, like something his kids would play with. So I don't know. That's such an odd thing. But there are other accounts where like some people did claim that like, oh well, maybe there were bodies, or like somebody saw like an arm, you know, from like out of the tarp. I mean, who really knows, you know? But it is fascinating. There is one more thing that I do want to get into, and that's a guy named John Murphy, and it's sort of a kind of a tragic sort of thing. So in Kecksburg, there was a guy that took a particularly strong stance against this sort of narrative of like, oh, it was just like a meteor. And he was a radio host and a news reporter for WHJB radio. Apparently he was on the scene of the crash. He spoke with a ton of witnesses, and apparently, which this is amazing, apparently he snapped several photographs. He had these interviews like recorded before like the, you know, I guess before like the full military crew came in and just like totally shut off, you know, shut it down. Mm. And so I guess he was able to get there like before, even though the military showed up like immediately, he was able to get there before. Apparently like the following day, all of his rolls of film were confiscated by the military. The story goes that he actually was able to keep one, which is interesting. His manager, Michael Mazza, would later state to seeing Murphy's pictures. Although they were dark and grainy, there was a definite cone-shaped object embedded in the ground. which that's pretty amazing. Apparently, the story goes that he was like preparing a full radio show that was even going to be titled The Object in the Woods that he was going to air, you know, in the next following nights. But before the show could go out, he was visited again by two government officials. You know, as you can guess, they had, you know, black suits, trench coats. And again, like, I'm not saying that they're men in black, but there's definitely like a vibe to this, you know what I mean? And we are still in that like 60s era, which is just, I mean, it's like our favorite era for ufology for sure. But he was visited by these guys, these two men in suits. They kind of threatened him. They took any research, any and all research notes that he had, all the photographs that he had left, all of his audio recordings. Apparently the show still aired, but it was like edited. And it was like a very short, like brief kind of like story, you know, in the whole of like the show. The tragic part comes with, I believe like 2 years later, maybe even a year later, he was on holiday with his family in California, and he was the target of a hit and run collision. A car basically ran him over, and the person that did that still remains a mystery. So, you know, call it what you will, maybe those things were related, and if so, that's really awful. And you know, you do kind of hear about this a little bit, like people being taken out, like eyewitnesses and stuff. But yeah, I think it's kind of a sad and kind of a cool aspect of the mythology of you know, the Kexburg case. So yeah, dude, that is the Kexburg UFO incident.
Yeah, man. I'm glad we finally did this one. And, you know, maybe it's one that some folks have heard before, but again, it's kind of obscure enough that, like, I feel like, I don't know, it's good to, I'm just glad we did it.
Yeah, I think that it is interesting because, like, it is one that we've talked about for years now, but it's interesting that there is so much or so little about this story, but yet you have something like the Roswell case, and I mean, I'm not saying there's like a lot of information, but there's been a ton like written about it. You know what I mean? Like, it's easy. You can just tell somebody like the term Roswell, and most people are going to be like, oh, like the UFO crash.
Right. Is but it because like maybe there was less, like this, we'll call it like quote unquote cover up.
Was it done
and performed in such a more efficient way, I guess, because there was no debris. They were able to kind of control the situation pretty quickly. Even though there were eyewitnesses, I guess it's easier for them to explain, oh, it's just a meteor, you know?
Well, that's like my point. I think the crazy part is like everybody kind of knows about Roswell, but the Kexburg case is so interesting because there were like so many witnesses, but then at the same time, like the witnesses like physically saw like the craft. It wasn't just like, oh, this guy saw like a piece of wreckage or they recovered this. It's like, no. Like this whole volunteer fire brigade shows up and they all like saw it. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I mean, it is interesting just like how fast the military showed up, but I don't know. It's a case that it is odd that it's not more widely sort of talked about, even within like, you know, UFO circles, really.
Yeah.
Weird. I love it though. Again, it does fall into that like 40s, 50s, 60s sort of sci-fi, you know, the height of ufology where, you know, you had all these like eyewitnesses and all this like lore that's just so fascinating, so like colorful and rich. And then for what it seems like, just the government was just like fighting to like just shut it down and, you know, keep the lid on it. But yeah, we love cases like this. If you want to find us, head on over to our Instagram. That would be rad. Leave us a comment, jump in the DMs, you know, tell us your own story. Maybe your small town, you know, domestically or internationally, maybe your own small town has its own, you know, UFO crash that we've never heard of. We'd love to hear about it, or your own like paranormal story, or maybe you've heard of a cryptid or whatever is local to you. Those are the things that we're really like into for sure. feel free to shoot us an email if it's more of a long form thing at thatwouldberadpod@gmail.com. Even better than that, we would love to hear from you, or we would just love you to visit thatwouldberadpodcast.com, where you can go to our website, you can listen to the show, you can do all of the things, you know, all the links are there. You can buy us a coffee, check out some merch, you know, whatever. Most importantly, my favorite part is that you can leave your own voicemail, like voice memo, of whatever you want to talk to us about. In fact, you know, I think we should open up a place on the site maybe where people can leave like a little like bumper. Well, that's like, I guess, industry talk, but like their own like, hey, this is so-and-so from so-and-so. And
yeah, they can do that from the site.
Yeah, like I want those. I want people to send in those. That would be awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah, a couple, by the way, that we're going to be using in a future episode, but yeah.
Oh, I love it. That's awesome. Yeah, like Joshua Cutchin and, you know, friends of ours. We've had several in the past, but yeah, hop on our website, tell us your own story, and maybe it'll show up in a future episode. If you love the show and you just want more of That Would Be Rad goodness, head on over to our Patreon, The Rabbit Trail. It's just more of what you love, and it really goes a long way to show your support, and it helps keep the lights on. So, yeah. Anything else, Woody?
I think that's it, man.
All right. Well, we love you. We appreciate you. And as always,
be rad.
That's the way it goes.
The way